Hey, it's Otis here. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I wanted to let you know that I just launched a brand new show. It's called The Daily Book Club, a daytime companion to Sleepy, where you hear entire books one chapter at a time, one day at a time. Simple as that. So if Sleepy is how you wind down your day, The Daily Book Club is a great way to start your day. There's new episodes daily. I read in a slightly peppier voice so that you can get really lost in these amazing stories that have stood the test of time. Or, just like Sleepy, you can sit back and relax and zone out to a good book. The first book we'll be reading is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth Von Arnim. Story is, in the 1920s, four women unfulfilled with life take a chance and abscond to a dreamy medieval Italian castle. It's a story dripping with wisteria, the beauty of solitude, and an unlikely pursuit of joy in Portofino, Italy. I think that this is a perfect story for the season, and you can hear it now. Find the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. This show has been a long time coming, and I'm so excited to bring you even more stories. So go subscribe to the Daily Book Club to hear what happens next. Thanks. This episode of Sleepy is proudly sponsored by ButcherBox. If you've listened to Sleepy for a while, you know that I love good food, eating well, and treating my body right so that I can take on my days. Well, ButcherBox helps you do exactly that. They deliver super high quality, 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, crate-free pork, and wild-caught seafood right to your door. It's humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. They have a huge variety to choose from. They are excellent deals. They've got recipes and guides and tips included, and there's free shipping, always. Eating well is a huge factor in getting a good night's sleep, as is sometimes saving the trip to the grocery store and taking some stress out of your daily schedule. I have been loving these deliveries for those reasons. Been cooking up their steak tips with eggs in the morning, with butter and scallions and soy sauce, and I also made a delicious brine chicken roast with lemon parsley gravy. So good. The prices for this kind of quality and convenience is really impressive. ButcherBox has made me very happy. So sign up at butcherbox.com/sleepy and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/sleepy and use code SLEEPY to choose your free for a year offer. Plus, get $20 off your first order. butcherbox.com/sleepy. Eat well, sleep well.
Welcome to the I Can't Sleep podcast with Benjamin Boster. If you're tired of sleepless nights, you'll love the I Can't Sleep podcast. I help quiet your mind by reading random articles from across the web to bore you to sleep with my soothing voice. Each episode provides enough interesting content to hold your attention, and then your mind lets you drift off. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. That's I Can't Sleep with Benjamin Boster.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, and you're listening to Sleepy. A podcast where I read old books to help you get to sleep. I've got another wonderful story from Johnston McCulley tonight, author of The Mark of Zorro. And before we get to the bedtime story, I just want to generally thank all of our wonderful patrons on Patreon.com. I am currently traveling right now, so this is recorded about 2 weeks ahead of time. And so I'm going to be reading the names of all of our brand new patrons when I get back in early May. But I just wanted to profoundly thank all of our patrons that currently are a part of making this show on patreon.com, which is a website where you can go on and support the people who make the stuff that you like. There's cool perks for donating. So if you donate $1, even a dollar or less, I will read your name in the opening credits of the next show after you do. At $2 a month, you get access to a totally ad-free version of the show. And at $5, you get access to our poetry feed, which is a bunch of episodes you've never heard before. So, if you'd like to be a part of making this show, go to patreon.com/sleepyradio. Thank you. And as always, the music you're hearing is by my good friend James Lepkowski, and the cover art for Sleepy is by Gracie Kanan. So tonight, I'm going to be reading another story by Johnston McCulley. So in the last couple weeks, I've really started reading him for the first time when I read The Mark of Zorro, which really, really loved reading that. And I really hope you liked it. He's got kind of this swashbuckling Sherlock Holmesy style to him. And it's kind of perfect for going into summer, I feel. Looking for a little bit more adventure. And his writing definitely has that. So tonight, I'm going to be reading the beginning of his kind of whodunit detective-esque novel. It really is kind of like Mark of Zorro meets Sherlock Holmes. And it is called The Black Star. So, I hope you can sleep soundly to this reading. This is definitely one of those readings that if you do somehow make it to the end without falling asleep, it's pretty riveting and you want to hear the next part. And while we don't do that on this show, we definitely do that on the new podcast that I just launched called The Daily Book Club, which you can listen to during the daytime. New episodes every morning, one chapter a day, and we read whole books, start to finish. So, if you want to hear books and actually find out what does happen next during the day, go find The Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. But for tonight, I hope you can sleep soundly to this story of The Black Star by Johnston McCulley. And now is the time for you to fluff up your pillow just how you like it. Feel yourself melt into your bed. Get real comfortable. Close your eyes. And let me read to you. Chapter 1. An Aided Escape. Winds whistled up the river, and winds whistled down from the hills, and they met to swirl and gather fury and rattle the city's millions of window panes. They carried a mixture of sleet and fine snow, the first herald of the winter to come. In the business district, they swung signs madly back and forth and roared around the corners of high office buildings and swept madly against the struggling trolley cars. They poured through the man-made canyons. They dashed out of the broad boulevards. And so they came to the attention of Mr. Roger Verbeck at about the hour of midnight, as he turned over in his warm bed and debated whether to rise and lower the window or to take a chance with the rapidly lowering temperature. "Beastly night," Verbeck confided to himself and put his head beneath the covers. He slept. And suddenly he awakened. A moment before, he had been in the midst of a pleasant dream, and now every sense was alert, and his right hand, creeping softly under the cover, reached the side of the bed and grasped an automatic pistol that hung in a rack there. From the adjoining room, his library, There came no flash of an electric torch, no footfall, no sound foreign to the apartment, nothing to indicate the presence of an intruder. Yet Verbeck sensed that an intruder was there. He slipped quietly from bed, shivering a bit because of the cold wind, put his feet into slippers, and drew on a dressing gown over his pajamas. Then, his pistol held ready for use in case of emergency, he started across the bedroom, taking short steps and walking on his toes. A reflection entered the room from the arc light on the nearest street corner. This uncertain light was shut off for an instant, and Verbeck whirled quickly, silently, to find another man slipping up beside him. It was Muggs, a little wiry man of uncertain age, who had been in Verbeck's employ for several years, valet at times, comrade in arms at times, willing adventurer always. Muggs bent forward until his lips were close to Verbeck's ear. "I heard it too, boss," he said. "Somebody in the library." Verbeck nodded. They crept nearer to the door. Inch by inch, Verbeck pulled aside one of the curtains until they could peer into the other room. A gleam from the corner arc light penetrated the library, too. It revealed the interior of the room in a sort of semi-gloom, causing elusive shadows that flitted here and there in such fashion that they scarcely could be distinguished from substance. Also, it revealed an open window near the fire escape, and it showed the form of a man standing before Verbeck's antique desk in a corner. Muggs bent beneath his master's arm to see better. He felt Verbeck grip his shoulder and looked up to find him indicating the open window. Like a shadow, Muggs, who also held a weapon in his hand, slipped through the curtains, crept along the wall, and advanced toward that window to cut off the intruder's retreat. An instant, Verbeck waited. Then he stepped into the room, found the electric switch, and snapped on the lights and leveled his automatic. The man before the desk whirled with a snarl that showed two rows of jagged, uneven yellow teeth. He took in the situation at a glance, saw Muggs at the window and Verbeck at the door, and he knew he had been caught in a trap. His eyes narrowed and flashed. He bent forward, giving the appearance of a rat at bay, and his hand dropped slowly toward his hip. "Better not." There was a certain quality in Verbeck's voice that told the burglar the man before him was neither nervous nor afraid, and would shoot if necessary. The thief's hands went above his head in token of surrender, and the belligerent light that had been in his eyes faded. "It appears," said Verbeck, "that we have discovered you in a delicate position." "Oh, don't try to be clever. I guess you've got me all right." "Rather unceremonious, this call," Verbeck went on. "Why didn't you send up your card from the office?" "Oh, be seated, please." Still holding his hands above his head, the burglar took the chair Verbeck indicated. "Now, Muggs," Verbeck said. Muggs had been waiting for the word. He sprang away from the window and took the cords from the portieres. Working swiftly, he bound the burglar's hands behind his back, then fastened them to the chair. Then he assumed the role of guard, and Verbeck lowered his pistol and walked toward the desk. "I fancy you didn't find much, my man," he said. "This is a bachelor apartment, you know, and there's little of value in the library unless you seek books or pictures." "Oh, if you had entered the dressing room now. But, of course, if you had done that, Muggs probably would have filled you full of lead first and made a complete investigation afterward. It is better for you that you didn't enter there. Why you should crawl into a bachelor's apartment when there are so many pretentious residences where silver and plate are to be found, not to speak of women's jewels, is more than I can fathom. You must be an amateur at this sort of thing. What is this? On the desk was a sealed letter addressed to Mr. Roger Verbeck, the address having been stamped with rubber type. In one corner of the envelope had been pasted a tiny black star. On the polished surface of the desk, other little black stars had been pasted. There was one also on a vase. There was another on the glass door of a bookcase. "The black star," Verbeck exclaimed. He turned swiftly to scrutinize his prisoner, but there was no expression on the man's face to denote that he showed interest, and he was looking at the floor. Muggs was watching the bound thief closely, but his dancing eyes and parted lips showed that Verbeck's words had interested him deeply. "So, we are honored by a visit from the Black Star, Muggs," Verbeck said. "Think of that. The cleverest crook the town ever had to worry over. The man who got the famous Smith diamonds and cracked a safe across the street from police headquarters, who has lifted half the silver in town and stripped society women of their jewels, and he has paid us a visit. We must be getting important, eh, Muggs?" "Yes, sir," said Muggs. "Well, well. The man everyone is looking for and cannot find, who has been sending naughty notes to the police, telling them how dull they are. I understand he even tips off what he intends doing, and then does it under their very noses. Very clever chap, for a crook. Declares all detectives in the world can't catch him. Suppose we see what is in this letter." He grinned at the prisoner and ripped the envelope open. In it was a single sheet of paper. The letter, too, was printed, and its uneven lines showed that it had been stamped one letter at a time. It was similar in appearance to the letters and newspapers declared the police had received. Verbeck read it swiftly. "Mr. Roger Verbeck. Last night, at a certain reception, people were talking of the Black Star. You made the remark that the Black Star was not a crook, but a gang, that the police didn't catch him because they had so many cases on which to work that they couldn't give their undivided attention to any particular one. You declared that any clever man who applied himself to the task could capture the Black Star and break up his gang. You boasted that you could do it yourself, and easily. To show you how useless it would be for you to pit your brains and skill against mine, I am putting this letter on your desk while you sleep in an adjoining room, and am leaving my sign on some of your belongings. I am even putting a black star in your bed, within a foot of the spot where you rest your head while you are sleeping. After this exhibition, either admit that the black star is clever, or do as you boasted you could do. Catch me." "Read it, Muggs," said Verbeck, guarding the prisoner himself as Muggs obeyed. "What do you think of that, eh? Intended us to wake up and find these things stuck all over the place, trying to show us how very clever he is, this naughty black star, and we catch him at it. There'll be joy at the police headquarters over this. Now you just keep your eyes on this gentleman, Muggs, while I get into my clothes, and then we'll continue the entertainment." Verbeck hurried to the dressing room, leaving Muggs on guard, and dressed as swiftly as possible. He carried a topcoat and cap to a chair near the door of the bedroom, and then he hurried over to the bed. The Black Star had done as he said. On the head of the bed was one of the little signs, and whoever had placed it there had put his hand within 6 inches of Verbeck's head. The man in the other room, Verbeck decided, had done that first, then gone into the library to finish his work. Verbeck hurried back and relieved Muggs. "Go and get your clothes," he ordered, and then hurry back here. I'll try to entertain our guest while you are gone. He drew up a chair and sat down, facing the prisoner, and less than 6 feet away. He was humming a tune, and there was a smile playing about his lips. Had the prisoner been well acquainted with Roger Verbeck, that smile would have put him on guard. Verbeck already had formed a plan. He and Muggs understood each other well, thanks to sundry adventures in which they had participated in the four corners of the earth, and he knew that Muggs, even now, was reading the note he had scrawled hurriedly and left on the dressing table, and would act accordingly. The Black Star. Well, well, he exclaimed, grinning at his prisoner again. And so you are the clever crook. I'm not saying anything. You decorated the head of my bed with that thing, I suppose. You can suppose all you like. Thanks. Rather surly, aren't you? You hand me over to the police and you'll get yours, said the prisoner. Are you by any chance trying to frighten me? I'm giving you fair warning. You hand me over, and you won't live long to gloat about it. Roger Verbeck grinned again and resumed his humming. His eyes never left the prisoner, but he was thinking deeply. In the first place, the letter from the Black Star bothered him. The remarks that the Black Star accused him of making he had made. But the puzzling part of it was that he had made them to half a dozen friends when there was no stranger near. He had spoken them in a drawing room in the presence of Faustina Wendell, his fiancée, Howard Wendell, her brother, and some others concerning whose integrity there was no question. How, then, had the Black Star heard of them? The Black Star had terrorized the city for the past 4 months. Whenever a master crime was committed, a tiny Black Star had been found passed on something at the scene of operations. The police had been unable to get a clue. Each crime seemed bolder and more daring than the one before, and more highly successful. The Black Star sent taunting letters to the newspapers and police, and the public demanded his arrest and imprisonment with loud voice. His crimes, too, showed a deep knowledge of private matters. It appeared that the Black Star knew the interior arrangements of the residencies he robbed. Sometimes he even knew the combinations of safes, for in the two instances a safe had been opened and looted, and then properly closed again, but with a tiny Black Star inside it. He was aware when valuable jewels were taken from safe deposit boxes to be worn at some affair. He knew when members of families were out of the city, or servants absent. He had shown in a thousand ways that he possessed knowledge of great value to a criminal. Roger Verbeck's boast had not been an idle one. He believed sincerely that no crook could be so clever, but what some honest man could match wits with him and win. He believed, too, that the Black Star did not work alone, but was the leader of a band. Not for an instant did Verbeck think that the man he had taken prisoner was the notorious Black Star, but it pleased him to let the prisoner believe he did. His first impulse had been to call the police and hand the man over. But he guessed that such a course would not ensure the capture of the master crook, and that the prisoner would refuse to talk, take a sentence for burglary, and thus allow the Black Star and others to go free. It would be clever, Verbeck decided, to allow this man to escape, to shadow him, and to learn more. Roger Verbeck had adventured with Muggs scores of times, and he yearned for an adventure now. Here was his chance. Besides, the Black Star had issued the challenge. Muggs returned fully dressed. For an instant, the eyes of master and man met, and there flashed between them an understanding. "Better look at this chap's bonds, Muggs," Burbeck said. "We don't want him escaping before the police come." Mug bent behind the prisoner's chair and fumbled with the cord, and when he arose, his eyes met those of Verbeck again, and Verbeck knew that Muggs had obeyed orders. "Now go down and call the house manager," he directed, "and I'll telephone the police." Muggs hurried out into the hall. Verbeck left his chair and stepped back to the door of the bedroom. "I fancy you'll be secure for a moment or so," he told the prisoner. "You'll scarcely get away unless you carry that chair with you." He backed through the curtains, grasped a top coat and hat, and crossed the room on his toes and unlocked the hall door. To cover the sound of the key turning the lock, he spoke as if calling a number on the telephone. "Hello? Police headquarters?" he asked. "This is Roger Verbeck speaking. Hurry up here. I've just caught the Black Star trying to loot my rooms." "My old address?" "Yes." And while he spoke, he opened the door so that his voice would drown any squeak the hinges might give, and then he slipped into the hall and hurried to the front stairs. He dashed down the three flights, four steps at a time. The prisoner had tugged desperately at his bonds and had felt them give. With sudden hope, he had worked furiously to get free. He was through the window and descending the fire escape as Verbeck finished the imaginary telephone message to the police, exulting at what he fondly thought had been his close escape. Chapter 2. The Black Star. Verbeck found Muggs at the corner of the apartment house, standing in the shadows and trying to shield himself from the stinging sleet and biting cold wind. "He's just reaching the ground, boss," Muggs said. "See him?" "I see him. Be careful now, Muggs. We don't want to lose him. Thanks for understanding and loosening his bonds. There he goes." The erstwhile prisoner had reached the ground and was darting through the shadows toward the alley. Down this he ran for half a block, then crept between two buildings, and so reached the boulevard near a corner, with Verbeck and Muggs 100 feet behind him. It was difficult trailing the man through a storm of sleet and fine snow, but Verbeck and Muggs had trailed men before, sometimes for amusement, and at other times through necessity. The man hesitated at the curb a moment, then struck across the driveway. Verbeck and Muggs followed. They took opposite sides of the walk and slipped along over the frozen ground, darting from shadow to shadow, always catching the elusive shadow ahead. At the street crossings, their quarry walked across boldly, and they could not follow instantly for fear of being detected. But they always picked up on their man again, once they were across. Thus they covered a dozen blocks, and it appeared that the midnight prowler considered himself safe now. He hurried down a cross street, his head bent forward against the cold wind that swept up the hill. Block after block, Muggs trailed him, while Verbeck shadowed from the other side of the street, dodging into dark doorways now and then when he expected his man to look behind. The quarry stopped at the corner, lighted a cigar, and stood waiting. Muggs concealed in a doorway 50 feet behind him. Verbeck was in another doorway across the street. An owl car came along, and their quarry boarded it. But Verbeck had been expecting that, and for some time he had been watching a taxicab standing before a drugstore on the corner. As the owl car started up again, Verbeck dashed across the street Then he had the chauffeur out of the drugstore and into the sea before Muggs reached the spa. "Follow that owl car," Verbeck directed. "There's a man on it that we'd like to see when he gets off." "I'm wise," the chauffeur cried. "Fly cops, eh? Get in." The cab lurched forward along the slippery street, keeping half a block behind the owl car. Whenever the car stopped, the cab drew up at the curb, and Verbeck put out his head to watch, but their quarry remained aboard. "If this keeps up, we'll clear out of town," said Muggs. "Anxious for action?" Verbeck asked, laughing. "You may get plenty of it before we are done. Have a bit of patience, Muggs." "I've got patience, all right, boss. And I've got a hunch, too. Let's have it." At times, Verbeck had a great deal of respect for Muggs's hunches. "I've got a hunch we'd have done better if we'd handed that gent over to the police. I give you credit for understanding the situation, Muggs." "Oh, I understand what you want to do, all right. It'd be great to clean up this Black Star and his gang single-handedly. Hog tie them all, then call in the cops and hand them over. Especially since you sent that sassy note. But I've got a hunch we're going up against a stiff game. The Black Star ain't no slouch." "Afraid?" snarled Verbeck. That touched Muggs on a tender spot, and Verbeck knew it. Muggs turned deliberately and faced his employer. "If that's the way you're looking at it, boss," he said, "trot right along and I'll be behind you. Go to the limit, and I'm in the first seat on the right-hand side. But all the same, I've got a hunch." The taxicab stopped again. Verbeck put his hands from the window and immediately opened the door. Their quarry had left the owl car and was starting down the dark cross street. Giving a bill to the chauffeur and telling him he need not wait, Verbeck hurried into the corner with Muggs at his heels. Shadowing here was difficult work, for there was unimproved property and some old estates not well kept up, where sidewalks were bad and the footing uncertain, and where untrimmed trees and thick underbrush furnished multitudes of dark spots. Uphill and downhill, always against the biting cold wind and sleet, their man led them. Finally, he crossed a vacant lot and made directly for an old house far back from the street in the midst of a grove of trees that were now swaying and snapping in the storm. "So that's where the Black Star lives," Verbeck said. He and Muggs had small difficulty following their man now, for there was a low hedge behind which, by stooping, they could make their way unseen. Their man reached the side of the house and went along it until he came to a door. Beside the door there was a box on the ground. As Verbeck and Muggs watched, the man they had been following raised the lid of the box and took something out. "He's putting on clothes," Muggs whispered. His actions could not be observed well, but it did appear that he was donning an overcoat or a robe of some sort. "And he's putting on a mask," said Muggs. "What's coming off here?" "I imagine we are in for an interesting time," answered Verbeck. "Watch him now." He had stepped up to the door, and they could see him put out his hand. Through a lull in the storm, there came to Verbeck and Muggs the tinkling of a bell. Then a sharp click, and the door flew open, and their quarry disappeared inside, closing the door after him. Verbeck and Muggs hurried around the end of the hedge into the house. A few feet from the door was a window. Verbeck had no more than glanced at it before Muggs was at work. Verbeck never had inquired too closely into Muggs's past. But, from what he had seen from time to time, He had reason to believe that Muggs knew a thing or two about Crook's methods, and now he had more evidence of it. In an instant, almost, Muggs was sliding that window up slowly, inch by inch, making no noise, and carefully pulling aside the curtains beside it. Another moment, and Verbeek was standing inside the house, with Muggs beside him. They heard no voices. Step by step, they made their way across the room to the opposite hall, searching for a door. Then they saw a streak of light that penetrated from an adjoining room, where a door sagged in its casement, leaving a crack through which a man could see. Verbeek knew this house. For several years, it had been deserted, not kept in repair, the grounds not kept up. It belonged to an estate in litigation and could not be sold, and the heirs had refused to build a more substantial residence for the rental it might bring in. He was surprised to find it inhabited, and he imagined that the Black Star and his band were making use of it surreptitiously. But when he applied his eye to the crack in the door, expecting to see a room almost barren, filled with dust and cobwebs, two or three boxes, some burning candles, a typical resort of thugs, he faced a surprise. He was looking into a room that had been newly decorated and was furnished lavishly. Expensive rugs were on the floor, pictures adorned the walls. There was a massive library table in the center of the room, an armchair beside it, books and papers and magazines on it. On one wall of the room was a small blackboard, with chalk and an eraser in a box beneath it. Before this blackboard, standing erect, was their quarry, dressed in a long black robe that covered every portion of his body, even his head being enveloped in a hood, and over his face, a black mask. There was no one else in the room. The man before the blackboard stood stiffly and silently, like a soldier at attention. Behind the door, Verbeek and Muggs waited, scarcely daring to breathe. Then a door on the other side of the lavishly furnished room was thrown open, and another man came into view. He too was dressed in a long black robe and had a black mask over his face, but he had a mark that distinguished him from the other, for on the front of his hood was a black star, formed of jet, that flashed in the light. Thank you for listening to Sleepy. Good night.